This is a real special treat for my podcast, Journey of an Aesthete, because we have a great episode, a great guest, Will Dodson. Welcome.
Hi.
Great to be here. I mean, it's really exciting for a couple of reasons, maybe more than a couple, maybe three or four reasons. You're a part of this wonderful book.
That's right.
The first of its kind, I think, right? On the great Wes Craven.
That's right. Well, actually, two collections came out in 2023, but that's the first one.
Right.
The films of Wes Craven, edited by Colm Wydow. But another critical companion to Wes Craven, edited by Fernando Pagnoni, also came out. And I'm pleased to say that I have an essay in that as well on Craven television films. Yeah. So, but it is, you're right. It's the first time Wes Craven has gotten the academic treatment. These are the first two books from academic presses.
Right.
Featuring real serious scholarship. There's been a lot of great books about Craven previous by some great journalists, great film critics, great scholars in their own right.
Sure. I mean, originally, my first introduction to him was through Robin Wood. Robin Wood wrote some really good, back in the 80s, 70s, wrote about Last House on the Left and The Hills Have Eyes and really intelligent pieces, at least for that time. But now you're part of that tradition. You're coming into that.
Yes, and I would say Robin Wood is definitely the godfather of both of these collections.
I wanted to start off in an unusual manner, kind of personally, because we could share stories of the first Wes Craven movie we ever saw, or how it affected us, or if you want to, a first horror film, if you want to go that route, or either. So, I mean, I guess I'll start as we've spoken before. The first Wes Craven I saw was The Hills Have Eyes in 1977 as a 9-year-old, right? Wow. Which is insane, right? At a grindhouse theater
in New York City. Start.
In New York City with my dad. And it was just, you know, I had seen other horror movies, adult, not X, but R-rated, of course, horror movies before, because I had seen, you know, well, movies that came out a lot in the 70s that were like that and that kind of material. And but I seeing this in a theater was a real experience. And I really don't think The Exorcist would have been the one I saw originally. Mm-hmm. So this would have been a film of that kind of emotional intensity to see as a boy after The Exorcist. And they for some reason, those are they're two very different films, but they're both really good films. Really. And I have to confess, I never became like a horror aficionado genre-wise, because I was always into many other things as well. But I think a seed was planted, and I think it's not accidental that, you know, I used to have parties at my house where I would show Last House on the Left and invite, 20-something's over, you know, this is in the 80s and VHS, and a lot of them had never seen anything quite like that. And so showing Last House And then, of course, I became aware of him as an auteur, as a filmmaker, because Shocker would come out. I would be first weekend to see People Under the Stairs, Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, all. And then, of course, culminating in the 90s, I was there opening weekend for Scream, which was exciting. I felt like this is a really great filmmaker, really original, unique, one of the great filmmakers in my view. But I've talked too much. What was your first Wes Craven or your first...
Well, it's interesting. You know, when you started talking, I had to rack my brain because, as a kid, and a teenager, I wasn't really much of a horror guy or even really a movie guy. I didn't come into films being a cinephile, I guess, until my late teens. So. Yeah. I'm sure that I saw Nightmare on Elm Street and films like that on VHS, but really, Scream in 1996, I was 18 and a college freshman, and it came out over the Christmas holiday, and I went to see it, and it really changed my life. I immediately became obsessed with Wes Craven and went back and watched all of his films. all of his television work, just everything that I could get. There was something about Scream that really captured that decade. Its tone, its sort of metatextual references, and just everything about it. And and then, you know, Wes Craven's one of the few filmmakers who could say that he made a film in three different decades.
That's right.
That really defined the genre for that decade.
What decade, you're right about.
So I guess that's kind of a boring answer to come into him through Scream.
Actually, good manager. I think Scream is an amazing film. And I would say there's almost no better way. I rewatched that film this past Halloween, you know, the series, and it really holds up. It really holds up really well. Courtney Cox and David Arquette and the acting and just the writing is just so, it's just such an intelligent film. And you're right. There's a kind of a sense of, maybe he's talking about the culture of the 90s, right? Kind of the, in that film, maybe the cult of easy affluence that marked those years, maybe, or the kind of the neoliberal celebrity, you know, the weather, you know, Courtney Cox is the weather, or the anchor, or the this and that. Yeah. There's a kind of sense of, he's satirizing always the era, the same way Nightmare on Elm Street. He's, I think, really prescient, I think, right, about issues of family trauma and things like that that other filmmakers weren't dealing with, I don't think, as much. I don't think as he was, or at least to that extent. So he was always on top of, well, of course, as we know, the family's his great themes, always dealing with toxic families and things like that.
And you know, his background really fed into that as a recurring theme, having grown up in a very repressively religious family who, he said he wasn't allowed to watch any films but Disney films until he got to college, which is where he kind of fell in love with filmmaking.
I mean, that makes him a lot like Paul Schrader, doesn't it? It reminds me of Paul Schrader being a Grand Rapids Calvinist, you know, and that, so they have us, even though they make very different filmmakers, they're similar, came to movies late and embraced movies. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a very apt comparison. And whereas the trauma explored in Paul Schrader movies tends to be located primarily in solitary men, Craven's tends to be located in the heart of the nuclear family, the neoliberal unit of social commerce, right? I'm laughing now because you made me make a connection between Paul Schrader's Hardcore and the adult film that Wes Craven made, Angela the Fireworks Woman.
That's right.
Not to start, you know.
Well, we should mention that he did. He got to start making hardcore features, I think, in an interesting time for hardcore, the early 70s, right? So he's not working in the late 70s like Gary Graver and you know, and Ron Sullivan, Alain Prichard, not that era, but kind of when hardcore had a more of a hippie orientation or more kind of a countercultural orientation, you know, like the Mitchell Brothers and all that. It has a feeling of that film. But of course, he got a lot of people got their start. I don't know what you feel that, how that affects later on. I mean, he learned filmmaking chops, I guess,
Well, I mean, you know, as far as I know, he part of his entree into that world was his connection with Peter Locke, who went on to produce The Hills Have Eyes.
That's right.
And Hills Have Eyes Part Two. You know, and he made The Fireworks Woman after Last House on the Left. So I think he was, from my understanding, and another scholar may correct me, but, you know, he was looking for work, and this was a viable sort of underbelly of the industry where he could get a film made. And In fact, the film does more or less neatly fall into his constant exploration of family trauma. In this case, the story involves a brother and sister with incestuous longings for one another, and the brother is said to be a priest. But the story is kind of interesting because the sister character feels all these pressures from the sort of hedonistic,
right.
Hippie life lifestyle society that she's become a part of. That's all I'll say about it.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I see it as a very much an era or a period thing, because if you think about Hills Have Eyes,
mm-hmm.
Last House on the Left, I think wasn't it John Landis who said that the movies of the 70s, the horror movies of the low budget horror movies of the 70s are much more emotionally intense or more provocative than the films he would go on to make, of course, you know, like American Werewolf in London, which are much slicker, more, you know, they're more, I'm not disparaging, I'm just saying the style is much more controlled and, you know, classical narrative and acting and drama and suspense. But these, a movie like Last House on the Left is just so powerful emotionally in the way Texas Chainsaw Massacre is. It's got that feeling.
Yeah, it really challenges the audience.
It really challenges the audience. And I'm wondering how much you think that is a function of underground filmmaking in that era in general, that directors were free to do experiment with them, points of view and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, that was a period where directors had so much more freedom to ignore their commercial prospects. Yeah. But for independence, which Wes Craven was at the time, and Romero, Hooper, horror offered a way to both make challenging cinema and give themselves kind of a commercial cushion, right? Because horror always finds an audience.
Right.
And if you're working independently and you're able to deliver, as Joe Bob Briggs once said, blood, breasts, and beasts, the three beasts. If you can deliver one or more of those elements, even if you're working in a low budget, you'll make your money back and be able to keep working. Of course, the trade-off is that you often get typecast into the genre.
That is true, because I just ordered a book I lost. I had a book in the 90s called Filmmakers on the Edge by Matlin. Do you know this book? A coffee table book by Maitland McDonald, I think her name.
Yeah.
And I lost my copy, and I finally found a used copy. I'm so thankful and happy, because that's got, I'm sure if you know the book, it's got a really long interview with Wes Craven and
yeah. You know. Yeah, McDonough's a great author. She did the first.
Dario Argento, Black.
Yeah, the first. Yeah, I think it was adapted from her master's thesis or something like that.
Broken Mirrors. I love that book. That's on my film shelf, definitely that. this is being added to it as well, and on the edge. But I'm wondering that thing about the 70s and kind of the era, and then the politics, because I always feel like Wes Craven movies, they're, as he goes on his career, he makes these blockbuster films like Scream that are very successful and very both classical and postmodern. They're meta, but they have a classical storytelling aspect, and they have, you know, in suspense, you know, the kind of thing that Hitchcock would have appreciated, right?
Yeah.
At the same time, I always feel like he's a committed filmmaker in a political sense. There's always, you know, he has very much, his films, even though they're horror films, have real compassion about injustice, I feel. In every film, I mean, I don't know if it would, you know, even Music from the Heart, well, especially maybe Music from the Heart, Meryl Streep, which we could talk about, which is his odd film out. Do you feel this is part of his integrity, that he always made sure that he was addressed these issues that were important to him? Or
I do think so. Yeah. I think one thing you can say for Wes Craven, whether or not you take issue with a particular film or whether or not a particular film is successful, he was very consistent in his themes and very much committed to you know, as you say, issues related to justice. He was very concerned with class, social class, economic class. Certainly race and racial injustice was important to him, as you see in films like People Under the Stairs.
Fantastic.
I wouldn't say his films were necessarily radical in that sense, but in a way, the fact that so many of them did find popular and mainstream currency makes them all the more impactful. You know, going back to the particular decades his films seem to be responding to, you know, in the 70s with Last House, with The Hills Have Eyes, the promise of the 60s had kind of been broken with the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, Vietnam, the sort of
Malcolm X,
the malaise, right? That apocryphally is credited to Jimmy Carter, and then in the 80s, you know, the Reagan era, that's when the suburbs and became the primary image
It's really rewatching Nightmare on Elm Street. That film is such an explicitly anti-Reagan film. I mean, we could say it's not a radical film, it's a commercial Hollywood movie, but make no mistake, that film is a real attack on the Reaganism. And it's other things too. It's not only that, but wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. The dark secrets at the heart of the quiet suburban community, the sort of capitalist isolation of families, of neighborhoods, ironically, right, the apotheosis of Freddy Krueger as a money-making icon, which surely was not part of the calculus for Wes Craven. But that certainly.
Is it true that he hated that? I'm sure you reached it. Which I don't know a lot about his feelings about that, but I imagine.
Well, I know he disliked the fact that in order to get the film made, he had to sign away most of his rights. So he didn't make any money off the sequels or off the merchandising or anything like that. So it becomes kind of ironic. You create this film that's critical of the Reagan era and Reaganomics that then becomes this franchise, and you're cut out of the fruit. And in some ways, it's a nice bookend with Scream, which I think. Is also a suburban film about dark secrets in families, but I think the word you might have used was slick or sleek. It really, the 90s were so defined by the fetishization of the past and the sort of, as we entered the internet age, the commodification of communication.
Sure.
And that film, which is so much about human connection and the different ways it can be severed, sometimes literally, it is in some ways, kind of a mirror image of Nightmare.
It is.
Which I find really interesting, and then of course it's meta referentiality, which is a word I think I just made up. is something of a piece with New Nightmare, right?
New Nightmare, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I actually, in many respects, like the '90s. I have some fondness for that decade because I think there are other decades that are worse in certain respects. I won't name which.
Oh, absolutely.
I won't name which.
The one we're in.
Right. Maybe closer to home than we both admit, but full disclosure and honesty. But I don't know. I think I'm just thinking about all of his films, like his TV films. One of my favorite movies is Summer of Fear, right? With Linda,
oh, yeah.
Blair. Linda Blair and Lee Purcell. What a performance. What performances. And but you told me originally that was, he didn't see that. He saw that film as a training film for himself or working on his chops, and that it was, which is amazing because you look at that thing so well made. What a well made
movie
it was.
Yeah. So it was the first time he'd used a dolly.
Uh-huh.
first time he was working with union actors, you know.
Right.
And again, right, that's a film that managed to work in this class consciousness as right. we have this upper class family being infiltrated by a witch from the Ozarks, you know.
Well, we also got that. I forgot Fran Drescher. So it's three great actors in that film. Lee Purcell, Fran Drescher, and Linda Blair. I mean, that's that. I mean, that casting is just.
Yeah, it's a film. Yeah, it still plays well today.
But it makes me think if someone makes a film that good, that well, you know, that well crafted, and there's, and yet it's still got that kind of looseness or rawness of the underground of sort of the last house. It's like kind of like a hybrid in a way. It's got a hybrid quality because it is a union shoot, and it's, you know, it's interesting what comes out when you combine different elements, right?
Yeah. And Craven had such an intuitive style that was really informed by his, you know, academic background in literature and philosophy.
Was he an English teacher?
He was. Yeah. And, you know, he didn't go to film school like many of his contemporaries did. He learned by doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the reasons his style is so, you know, even in the later years, you can find elements of rawness to it. And I say that as a compliment. There's always something disruptive.
Always.
In films.
Every film. That's why I describe it as a hybrid quality. It's almost like he's working. It's like his soul is from 1975 and Last House, right?
Yeah.
He's taking that soul into studio filmmaking.
Yeah.
And the result is like New Nightmare and Shocker. And so the result is really, in some respects, more interesting or more creative than if he were only in the alternative genre. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like it creates a new, it's hard to explain. It's almost like he creates a new style or a new out of that, out of the meaning of those things. I don't know what you.
Yeah, you might even call it something like therapeutic horror.
Yeah.
Because he's always trying to work something out.
Yes.
You know, I mean, trauma informs the horror genre in general, but specifically for Craven, trauma related to familial relations, trauma related to class issues, and then the films themselves become kind of a way of working through those problems.
Yeah.
Not always successfully for the characters, but I think that's why he revisits these themes so relentlessly, even in his most commercial films, like Shocker, for example, which he specifically wrote to try to create a new franchise that he could profit from. But that too is a film about, a teenager working out issues related to parental loss. Trying to figure out who he is. There's a lot of, you know, even in the comedy, and Shocker's a pretty funny film.
It is.
But even in the comedy, there's this feeling of loneliness and loss that I think
is
attractive for someone like me. I find those films very relatable. And I think many fans do, you know, it's a way for them to confront their own feelings about family and loneliness and so on while still having a laugh, you know.
Well, there is a lot of humor in Shocker. You're right. It's interesting. Well, there's, it makes me think. So where do we, what, how, what sense do we make of music of the heart?
I love music
of the heart. Both love music of the heart, but don't you think there's a little that's a piece of the other films that even though it's non-horror, it's this musical about inner city kids trying to keep their music program intact, you know? And
yeah. I mean, obviously, I mean, class themes are right there, right? Yeah. And I know the film has been kind of dismissed by some critics as a white savior narrative, to which you kind of have to counter that by pointing out that it's based on a true story, of a woman, you know, trying to keep this program going in cooperation with Cooper. So it's really more complicated than that. But one thing that I've argued elsewhere is that, you know, almost all Craven films have some dream imagery.
They do. Right?
Dreams, nightmares, dream sequences. I mean, they're in pretty much everything from starting with Last House on the Left and going all the way through. And I would argue that the dream imagery, the dream logic of music of the heart is the music.
Yeah, absolutely.
When these kids are playing and you see them lost in their reverie, when you kind of close your eyes and hear the soundtrack of the film moving you from scene to scene, I think that's how Craven incorporated dreams into that film. And I find that fascinating. I don't think there's any interviews where he said as much. So I'm not suggesting it was deliberate. But I think it's...
Oh, I think it's conscious. I mean, he may not verbalize it the exact way you just did now, but it's definitely. But that gets us a whole discussion of what musicals are, and you know that's a whole.
Sure. I
mean, you're getting into Linda Ruth Williams territory a little bit there.
Right. I'll definitely cede the expertise to her on that. I think Music of the Heart is really ripe for rediscovery. I hope more people check it out. It is, you know, Craven's most middle of the road movie. I mean, he's not necessarily doing anything radical there, but there's still that relentless focus on class and dreams and family.
Yeah, absolutely. Family comes in all different types, though, right? Like, family could be a music class. That could be the family, or
exactly,
or musicians, not necessarily parents, but not necessarily blood. Interesting. What is your feeling? I wanted to ask you because you would have a lot of. I mean, as you may not know, I've had Amanda Reyes twice on my show. Been blessed to have her presence and. Doesn't she know more about TV than the rest of us combined? I mean, isn't she? What are your?
I think Amanda Reyes is an icon.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a very small but very energetic community of people who love audio commentaries and bonus features on physical media, and I'm certainly one of that group as someone who contributes special features myself, and she is. She, along with, I'd say, Sam Deegan, are really the gold standards of research and accessibility. Mm-hmm. Reyes has such a personable quality to her talks. You know, audio commentaries can be very boring, but hers are always so lively, so well, so accessible. My dream, I was saying before we started recording, my dream is that Wes Craven's TV movies will get a box set with Amanda Reyes doing commentaries for them all.
that would be great. You have commentaries coming out, right? Did you just record one, or did you have one?
Yes, I'm part of a company with my friend Ryan Barrell called Someone's Favorite Productions, and we have several projects coming out in 2024. The only ones that I can mention at this point. Severin Films' new release of the 1988 John Franco Gianni horror film, The Spider Labyrinth.
Wow.
We contributed a commentary and a short documentary to that. And then Film Masters is putting out Jack Arnold's The Swiss Conspiracy. Jack Arnold, of course, directed Incredible Shrinking Man, Creature from the Black Lagoon. And so we contribute a short documentary about Jack Arnold's career to that one. And there have about a dozen more that'll be announced in 2024, but I can't say them yet.
Yeah, you have to follow the rules or whatever the contracts are. And I'm not trying, of course, I never try to,
Thank you for mentioning
it. I'm already mentioning it because until this episode, I didn't know you had done those, and I'm excited about them. Jack Arnold, because I really like that film.
Yeah, The Swiss Conspiracy was a real revelation. I hadn't seen it before until, and it was his last theatrical film.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah.
When did you first encounter Carol Clover's book, Men, Women, and Chainsaws?
Oh, yeah. Well, right about the time that I saw Scream, I got instantly into not just film studies, but horror studies in particular. So I guess around 97, I read her book, Men, Women, and Chainsaws. And as a sidebar, my sister actually was in a movie that Carol Clover was in. They didn't do scenes together, but it's called Sandman by, I forget the director's name, but my sister was murdered and left in a bathtub. But it's, but Carol Clover plays a version of herself, and she's interviewed as an expert on horror tropes.
I've seen that movie. That's your sister? Yes, I've
seen that. She's in it very briefly. I was proud of her performance.
I didn't make the connection with her as the academic. I was probably just watching the movie, and it wasn't.
But Clover's work is really interesting in that it not only offered an appealing and in many ways accurate analysis of horror films. But it also inaugurated its own concept. So once Clover created the Final Girl concept, people started following the rules that she set. Hmm. So, in some ways, some of her perspectives, I think, as time has gone on and more critics have come in and reappraised, some of her ideas are maybe less relevant than they seemed at the time. But in other ways, they've become part of the lore. I mean, this is an example of an academic influencing the genre that she analyzed. I think her most, and this will bring it back to Craven too.
Yeah.
Her most important contributions, because Clover's specialty is Scandinavian literature. She came at these films studying them as mythology.
Right.
And I think that is a really important way of thinking about the horror genre, is this sort of these modern retellings of ancient myths.
Absolutely.
And certainly Freddy Krueger is a mythological creature par excellence.
I'm wondering what you thought of her ideas more generally. Like, if to a lay audience that's never heard of Carol Clover, doesn't know what the Final Girl means, how would you describe what was new in the way she looked at these so-called slasher movies, or what was she saying about? You think you had to end up a bit hard question to
Good question. I haven't read this book in many years, but I'll try to remember. So the Final Girl concept, and I'm glad you bring up that question, because I think a lot of casual film conversations include the phrase "Final Girl" without necessarily knowing what it entails.
Right.
The concept refers to the nearly always female sole survivor of slasher films, who, through resourcefulness and a little bit of luck, manages to turn the tables on the killer, sometimes by appropriating his weapon, and the killer is almost always male. Right. But as time has gone on, I think critics have expanded on the final girl in productive ways by noting that there are often gender problems or gender complications. In Clover's formulation, the final girl is at times negatively masculinized. Mm-hmm. And Clover points out that often the final girl's name will be like a masculine version of a woman's name, and that in appropriating the sort of phallic weaponry of the killer, that there's this tendency to masculinize. And then, of course, in later years, as the final girl kind of became codified in the genre, as the slasher genre, because mm-hmm. Clover's essay was very early. It was like 80, 81. So the slasher genre hadn't even really become... And so post-Clover, the final girl became very rigid. And so you see the rules that Jamie Kennedy as Randy gives in Scream.
That's right.
Don't have sex. Never say you'll be right back. Those sorts of things. And the biggest element, right, is that, and this is used as criticism of slasher films a lot of times, is that there's allegedly this very conservative punishment of teen characters who have sex, right? The final girl has to be a virgin. In fact, that's why it was a big deal in Scream that Nev Campbell does have sex with Billy, right, with Skeet Ulrich's character Billy Loomis.
Absolutely.
Survives.
Well, that's what makes Scream a movie for our era. When I say our era, I mean something that's after the 50s or past.
Yeah.
So that's very, of course, it's very progressive on Wes Craven's part.
Yeah.
But having said that, I've always been puzzled by this. I can see where people are offended by the Jamie Lee Curtis figure. Is that what it is? It's kind of like that they feel it's always a certain type of
type of
woman or girl.
Sure.
But if you go back, I'll go back and look at Halloween. Jamie Lee Curtis doesn't really fit that.
No, you're right. And
Jamie Lee Curtis is very. I think she escapes stereotyping. She's a very unique character, and I'm not trying to say that. Look, it's Halloween. It's not, you know.
It's not, I agree. And I think part of the problem of the final girl concept is, I think, a fundamental misreading of Halloween. And John Carpenter, in interviews, tried to combat this misperception of teens being punished for engaging in sinful behavior, right? Doing drugs, drinking, having sex. But the point was that on Halloween night, all the adults were gone.
Mm-hmm.
These teenagers who were transitioning from childhood to adulthood,
right,
were vulnerable. And where are you the most vulnerable? When you're having sex, when you're experimenting with these taboo things like drinking and drugs,
right,
they're children who are experimenting with adult behavior, right? That's what a teenager is, right? And so from Carpenter's point of view, he wasn't punishing these teenagers for having sex. It's just these were the places where they were hidden from adult eyes and they were at their most vulnerable. No one was going to be able to save them, except for in Jamie Lee Curtis's case. Well, really, she doesn't save herself. Dr. Loomis comes in at the last moment and shoots Michael Myers. So, So I think the final girl and Clover's research is really rich and rewarding, but also has over the years been revised in ways that I think are really important. Although the popular conception, right, of slasher movies and of the final girl still has that very conservative reading, which is too bad.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Of course, it's a whole separate question, you know, or what does it mean to say that a movie is conservative or liberal, right? It's kind right. of, I actually got a letter in the Boston Globe published.
Oh.
Basically defending the movie Knocked Up. Because the critic of the Boston Globe said that Knocked Up was an anti-feminist, you know, conservative right-wing movie. And I said, what are you talking about? Knocked Up is a 30s screwball movie. It's not liberal or conservative. It's about trying to make sense of their life and make sense of pregnancy. And it's actually a good movie. And I kind of was my way of getting frustrated over what critics can misread, I think, films like Knocked Up. You know, I don't know.
It couldn't be a conservative movie. Otherwise, that would make Seth Rogen's character, who is an undocumented immigrant, the hero. And I know we couldn't have that, could we?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, but that's an example of the kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
At their more, I don't know, ideological or kind of literal minded, maybe is how I'd put it. But
yeah,
there's a lot of that. There's a lot of things like that movie. Things that, and I think some of this anti slasher stuff is a little bit like that. Not all sure. of it, but some of it is. Some of it is.
Sure. I mean, we bring our own ideology into our viewership as well.
Of course, I'm biased because I'm a Judd Apatow fan. I think he's a good writer. I like it. So, I mean, of course, I have my bias. I mean, I'm not going to.
Sure.
I'm not going to hate on his films unless he makes some film I don't like. So, you know, that's got to, it's the way things are, right? I don't know.
Yeah. I think my favorite Judd Apatow movie is the Fat Camp movie he made for Disney, Heavyweights, early in his career. That is a strange,
terrific movie.
Strange film.
Very much so. Heavyweights, yeah. Right?
Heavyweights, right, yeah.
Well, you know, making comedy and horror similar, right? They occupy that kind of, I mean, society pushes them into the lower, right?
Sure.
They share that kind of, what would be the word? Not déclassé exactly, but sort of low brow or low rent sort of.
Absolutely. Which I find so ironic because comedy and horror are much more difficult to do well. It's easy to make somebody cry, you know?
Yeah. Making somebody laugh or scaring somebody is.
Yeah.
I want to ask your thoughts on William Friedkin's love for the Babadook.
Oh, the Babadook.
And you recall William Friedkin at the end of his life said, this is the best movie I've ever seen. Just gosh, this is better than my own Exorcist. And really, do you share his love for the Babadook? I
like it very much. In fact, I should probably revisit it. I think it's very interesting that it's become kind of iconic in the LGBTQ community. I remember at the time going to see it with my wife, and it hit both of us as parents very hard, but her in particular.
Oh, right.
Because I think there's something about the exhaustion of
parenting.
Especially a single parent of a small child who is being relentlessly annoying. Mm-hmm. Or more seriously, who is going through mental health issues and is just really wearing down on the patients. Of a parent. And so I remember the experience of watching that film being just harrowing for both of us, but for my wife in particular. I thought it was very effective in its psychological makeup and in, you know, the monster scares.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I can certainly, well, I don't want to be too shallow in this, but I could see just on the surface why a film like this might appeal to Friedkin, because so many of the themes are of a piece with The Exorcist, I would think.
Yep.
You know, the horror coming from within,
mm-hmm.
Besieged single mother with a troubled young child, you know, the similarities there are pretty obvious. Yeah.
And maybe even cruising into Live and Die in LA. Who knows?
There may be some connections.
There may be similarities between things that people may not.
Yeah. The Babadook is a very interesting film.
Which do you like better, Babadook? I mean, we need to talk about Kevin, or is that not a fair? Is that something you can compare?
I'm going to reveal myself to be flawed as a film scholar. I have not seen We Need to Talk About Kevin yet. I need to. My wife loved that film. Yeah, she's seen it. So I'll have to ask her which one's better and come back.
Your wife sees a lot of movies?
She does. She's a big horror fan. In fact, I made her watch the entire filmography of Wes Craven, including his television work from beginning to end. And when we got to Music of the Heart, she was very resistant.
Really?
But I made her watch it. It's just not the kind of film that she's normally into. She reluctantly liked it.
Okay. Well, it's the power of Meryl Streep and Mariah Carey or maybe.
Well, and we're both teachers, so she resonated with the story very much. I think that, the connection between all the filmmakers we're talking about, right, is this focus on families. And
we forgot about the TV work of Susan Lucci. What is the movie of Wes Craven? What's it called?
Invitation to Hell.
Invitation to Hell.
Yeah,
is Susan. A cult that's like brainwashing this town.
Right. It's Susan Lucci may or may not be the devil. She at least is some sort of demon.
That's right.
And the premise is this big corporation has headhunted the brilliant scientist played by Robert Urich and lured him from the Midwest with his family out to California. And all the employees of this big corporation are given memberships to this health club, which turns out to be a portal to hell, and it steals the souls of everyone.
Right.
Kevin McCarthy has a cameo. There's some definite Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Right.
But again, it's a film about a nuclear family in the suburbs being torn apart from within. And you know, it has some ludicrous parts to it, but I think it holds together.
The thing about Wes Craven is that he uses Susan Lucci's skills, her you know, the kind of actor she is. I think only a really great director can do that. Know how to cast something and use the gifts that someone brings and puts it in a different context outside of soap opera, outside of, and try to,
right,
kind of almost, and it's just, isn't that interesting? Think about a director directing Susan Lucci, Meryl Streep, Johnny Depp, name some of the other, Drew Barrymore,
right,
Courtney Cox, David Arquette,
John Saxon, Robert Englund,
I mean, that's the other thing too that doesn't often get talked about is the relationship between directors and casting and what they do with actors. That's a really, that's a thing.
Of all the filmmakers I've ever researched, there have been more, you know, actors never say anything bad about their directors, at least while they're alive. But reading actors recount their experiences with Wes Craven, they're very consistent in singing his praises for how supportive and gentle he is with actors and helping them find their comfort level and bring out the characters. I think, Robert Englund, of course, has talked about developing the character of Freddy Krueger. But all, you know, Neve Campbell, Courtney Cox, all of them have gone on record that Craven is a very open collaborator, firm in his vision. I'm not a pushover by any means.
Speaking of Neve Campbell, do you know the latest about Kevin Williams and Neve Campbell? They're returning. Do you know what the latest news of that? They're gonna, are they gonna come back together? Is, does Kevin Williamson want her to?
Are you talking about the Scream?
I think so. Yeah.
Oh man, nothing good's happening there right now. The most recent news I've heard, well, as far as I know, Neve Campbell is still out because they didn't offer her a salary that she found to be appropriate.
Right.
And now, of course, there's some controversy because Melissa Barrera was fired for making some statements in support of peace in Gaza that were interpreted.
I haven't been following that. I mean, everybody's spoken on Middle East now. And that's kind of
right. And Jenna Ortega is out also because of some salary disputes. So whatever happens with Scream 7 moving forward, it may or may not be in the same universe there.
I don't know. It's hard to know. I mean, just because we're in an interesting time. And what are your thoughts about just in terms of theater, streaming? I mean, we're in an interesting time, right? And then, of course, the strike has just ended. Any reflections on...
Well,
I mean, initially it seemed very positive, the ending, I mean, the strike, because it looks like, well, you know, the actors are going to get, the writers and actors are going to get what's deserved and what's, you know, they're right. But maybe not, I don't know. It's hard to make sense of it. It's kind of hard to.
Well, certainly. Yeah. What is the ancient Chinese curse? May you live in interesting times.
Yeah.
Certainly anyone working in Hollywood is living in interesting times with streaming and AI. You know, it's good that the writers and the actors have managed to work out some protections with regard to AI and, you know, stability in the writers' rooms. I think it's clear that there's going to be a lot less television produced mm-hmm. than there has been over the past decade or so, with the hope that, you know, there'll be more stability and more opportunities to collaborate for the writers.
You know, I'm going to be real honest with you, Will. I'd rather have less quote unquote content, whatever that means.
It's hard to stay up.
I'd rather have less stuff out there.
Yeah.
Have stuff be better made.
Yeah.
And have the writers and actors be paid a lot, be paid. That's my bias, but that's, I'm just one guy, you know, I don't know.
No, I agree with you. I think that, you know, residuals made a lot more sense in the traditional broadcasting model. The subscription services just don't bring in the same amount of revenue and never will. And that's why you're seeing so many of these streaming services cut content to take tax write-offs and to save money by not having to pay out to as many people. So, you know, if you're trying to break into the industry, you might find that it's harder than ever before. But if you're working in the industry, you might find some more stability. As far as theater versus watching films at home, it's almost a moot question because we're never going back. You know, you can get.
Of course, we're not going back. That wasn't really my question about.
Sure.
You actually answered my question because you.
Oh, okay.
You feel that we're going to work out some kind of. You feel that that because of the strike and because of the pressure put on the studios, that they're gonna make progress and they're gonna be able to find something.
I hope so. That's my optimistic view. Certainly the publicity towards the studios and studio heads during the strikes was fairly negative. And I think that you're seeing a bit of a shift in, you know, people like Zaslav's public comments about wanting to get the producers and the writers and the actors back to work and making great movies again. You know, we're seeing great success in theaters with the Barbie and Oppenheimer double header and Scorsese and As there seems to be superhero fatigue, that might be a good thing for mid-budget films going theatrical. I hope so. And certainly, even as big box stores like Best Buy transition out of physical media, boutique companies releasing Blu-rays and 4K editions of films on physical media, there's never been a better time to be a cinephile, because you can get access to so many more films than ever before. And listen to great people like Amanda Reyes or myself talk about the films. So I don't know. I don't know what.
Yeah.
Interesting time. Yeah. I want to be very optimistic about the results of the strikes and about the sort of growing, albeit small, market for physical media and the renewed interest in theatrical, the theatrical experience. But it's never been easier for the average person to make a film. And it's never been easier for the average person to see a film. So that gives me a lot of optimism for the future of the art.
You've been really generous with your time, and I'm greatly appreciative. I'm coming on my humble podcast to talk about this stuff. But even good things come to an end like this episode. But before we conclude, I want to ask you about your teaching life, or about the kinds of things your syllabus, or the kinds of things you're doing there, because I don't think we got.
Oh, sure.
What are the kinds of things that you're working on there in terms of class creation and, I mean, courses, and I don't know, at your school there?
Yeah, well, I've been very fortunate to have a lot of freedom in the types of courses I teach, in addition to the general introductory courses for undergraduates. I was probably my most popular class that I've developed is a course on cult films.
Wow.
And that course starts generally with Todd Browning's Freaks.
That's right.
And goes up to, we make it up to kind of modern martial arts films. So we get to the
Shaw Brothers.
Yeah, we get to Shaw Brothers. We get to Thailand. And
I have to ask: are you able to see, like, how do kids receive Pink Flamingos now, as opposed to Eric? Or, you know what I mean? I'm just curious. I got out Zardoz. Or do you show? I mean,
I usually try to introduce John Waters through Desperate Living rather than Pink Flamingos. Pink Flamingos, you got to ease them into it. Actually, I introduced them to John Waters, the person, first.
Oh, fantastic.
You know, hey, this is the guy who got David Lynch, you know, his first theatrical success with Eraserhead. Once people get into get into it, they're pretty happy. I really enjoy that class because so often it gets students who are not already fans of cult and exploitation films, so everything I show is really new. And
you're saying their minds are getting blown because they haven't seen some of these things.
I am very proud that that almost 20 years of students at this school graduate knowing who Doris Wishman is, and having had to think deeply about Frank Henenlotter's Frankenhooker.
guess when I saw Frankenhooker?
Oh, when?
I saw it opening night at the New Art Theater in Los Angeles. I just happened to be visiting Los Angeles in 92, and it was so, what a treat.
What a night that must have been.
Those were the days. I was wondering, have you seen this new film, What We Do for Love, I want to have two questions related about the erotic Shannon Tweed directed video documentary, or what's it called? Oh, yeah. Have you seen that film yet?
We Kill for Love, right?
Is that what it's called? We Kill for Love.
I just got a copy in the mail.
Okay.
I'm very excited because several of my favorite directors are represented in there. Jim Wynorski, Fred Olen Ray, Shannon Tweed, of course. The queen of the mid-90s erotic thriller. Well,
since you have not seen it yet, I have seen it, and I will not know. We'll have to come back and curious the thoughts about that. My other question is, have you met Eric Schaefer? Do you teach his?
Oh, I've not had the pleasure of meeting him in person, but yes, I do teach out of his book, what is it, Bold, Daring, Shocking, True. And that's the early years of exploitation filmmaking from about 1919 to 1945. So the original exploitation films, Mom and Dad and right. Child Bride, stuff like that.
I know that book is kind of an era that people often don't think about, but he was the first person to cover that, you know, and kind of talk about.
Yeah, definitely a forefather for my work. I appreciate it. But I don't just teach. I also get the pleasure of teaching a course on musicals and a course on westerns and things like that. So it's been a lot of fun over the years teaching film history, film theory. Yeah.
You do it all, which is why why this has been such an enjoyable episode.
Well, yeah, they there's not much money in it, but there's a little bit of freedom at least.
Well, is there anything else you want to mention or say before we conclude, or anything on your mind about films or anything else that you want to kind of?
Oh, I'm just so happy to get a chance to talk about Wes Craven, about his artistry, his impact on the genre. I thank you so much for having me. I want to thank Matthew Sorrento, who originally connected me with your podcast, which I'm so happy to now be listening to. And just thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you, Will. And it looks like you haven't seen the We Kill for Love yet. We'll have to come back and dig into that film because that's quite a...
It's about 3 hours long, isn't it? I'm gonna have to carve out some time this weekend.
Well, it's his motto was Tom Anderson's movie. Los Angeles Plays Itself. So it was right. And so he tries to copy that. It's a whole other discussion, but those are two, not to get to geek or nerd out on some of these things, but
oh well, I'll let you know.
There's a narrator and there's, you know.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I will definitely let you know.
Right. Well, I'm curious to hear your thoughts and have a good rest of the week and happy holidays to you. And
thank you. Happy holidays.
Thank you.